Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and of course I'm Al Warren. Now I've got the game with me today, Mr. Brian T.
There it is. Turns, turn off, whatever you want
turn,
to say.
Turn, keeps on turning. Are you still getting people coming after you? Or?
In fact, nobody came after me. So even after you made that announcement, not even one person tried to reach out on social media. So nobody cares. But
nobody cared. They were like, who does this guy think he is?
We also have to have listeners for that to happen, too.
That's true. I mean, both listeners, they were both off that day. I only pay people 5 days a week to listen. I can't afford this. Well, you know, actually, the guy I got published, you know, I helped that Ed Cleaves get his book published.
Which one was that? Which
Edward Cleaves, Kind Soul, Closet Maniac. He was some Boston guy that did. Anyway, I got that book published back in February, and he's been doing fine. But the thing is, he contacted me today, and I thought of you. He has all these people, hassling him now. He had some guy say that he was outside of his condo building. And had a picture of it. And he said, I'm waiting for you and stuff. And he actually had a picture of where he lives.
Oh, that's creepy as hell. It was also me doing that to him, but like.
Well, yeah, I thought that was pretty creepy. And he wanted to know what he should do. And I told him, contact the gang.
And mine is just forwarded to your email address. So it's automatic.
Yeah, it's one big roundabout, but that's all right. It keeps people busy while they're waiting.
So, it's idiot proof.
Yeah. Well, nothing's idiot-proof now. Come on. We had Trump here, so, you know, take that, Tucker. Okay, well, anyway, on to this. Our show today, we're going to be talking about Jimmy the King. And no, that's not you, Brian. And Murder, Vice, and the Reign of a Dirty Cop. And we've got the author, Mr. Gus Garcia Roberts. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
You can address Alan as Alan the Queen.
The two listeners you mentioned, I hope that they're tuned in right now.
Yeah, I'm paying them today. Yeah, okay, I told them it was a big one, so we wanted to bump ratings. So they said they could bring a friend too. So,
whoa, you know, I appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
That'll be 50% more listeners. Three. Oh, well, anyway. You've got quite the history. I take it that you're more of a sports guy by some of your reporting, or am I wrong here?
So right now, my day job is as an investigative reporter in the sports department for the Washington Post. But previously, before that, I've kind of I've been in on various I teams or investigative teams for major newspapers for about a decade, and LA Times, USA Today, and then Newsday, which is in Long Island, New York. I actually did more law enforcement stuff, like a lot of law enforcement misconduct stories and stories about sort of how bad cops get away with it and stuff like that, which led to this book. For the last year or so, I've been at the Washington Post focusing on sports, and it's kind of a fruitful arena because there's a lot going on below the surface in sports, and not a ton of people covering it in an investigative manner. So you find, there's a lot of stories that are kind of just swirling around, waiting for somebody to come scoop them up, and so it's been a busy year.
Why do you think they don't really get anybody following these sort of sports scoops? Is it because they idolize them too much?
I think that reporters who cover sports, the majority of them are beat reporters who often travel with the team, or they cover primarily one league. I think even with the best reporters in that situation, you're going to sort of sometimes be numbed to something, and I'm thinking of like back in the day of the steroid era in baseball. It took a reporter who was not a beat reporter, but who happened to be in a locker room working on another story, and noticed, in St. Louis Cardinals slugger Mark McGwire's locker some performance enhancing drugs, and asked questions about it and wrote about it. And I imagine a lot of beat reporters saw it before, but perhaps there was something sort of unwritten ethic that you don't talk about what you see in a player's locker room, right? So I think that that's sort of an example of what could be going on. I mean, another thing is just those people that cover sports for a living are typically extremely busy covering sports, and it's sometimes hard to sort of take the time needed to dig deeper into, systemic issues, systemic scandals brewing. I think there's also something to be said for having like a skill set that comes from not having covered sports and, covering the courts and covering the police. And you learn how to navigate the court system. You learn about sort of legal stuff, and you are sort of able to apply that to the business of sports. And, with newsrooms shrinking, there's just not a ton of resources that these newspapers have to throw towards investigating sports. And, Washington Post sports I team, I think, is a pretty rare beast at this point. So I think all those factors contribute to that.
Yeah. Well, if they put me on it, I'd be in the locker room all the time.
If like looking around.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I'd be watching. But that's a different story. When you get into this about dirty cops and how cops go bad and all that, do you feel a little bit, do you have to feel a little bit defensive, I wonder, because there's right now and in the last few years, there's been so much on policing, killing people and all the weird stuff going on. But at the same time, there's a pushback from the cop side. So if you're actually out there writing something about a dirty cop and bad cops, even in reports and stuff, doesn't that kind of, do you become kind of a target in a sense?
Do you mean like physically, like do I feel like
fear? Yeah, do you ever feel a little worried that, you know, you're out in the streets and it's like, oh, here's that guy?
Yeah, I mean, look, frankly, so I started reporting this book in earnest in 2017, which was when I left Newsday for the Los Angeles Times. And I had sort of thought that this subject was, you know, ripe for a book because the main character, James Burke, who becomes this corrupt police chief of one of the largest jurisdictions in the United States and has this really wild saga of his rise and fall, that he was like so characteristic of, you know, the failures of policing in the United States. And so I just thought it was a great book, but I didn't get going on it until 2017, which was when I happened to move to Los Angeles. And so reporting on this was like a logistical nightmare in some ways because I had to talk to a lot of cops for this book and you know, source up cops essentially, like dozens of them. And that's tough to do when you're on the other side of the country. Like cops are, I mean, there's a parallel between sports and police is, you know, they have these insular cultures where they don't really talk to outsiders. And that's sort of like ingrained. So I had to figure out how to do that from on the other side of the coast with some visits, of course. But, you know, I guess the plus side is I felt a little bit more secure because, you know, I definitely feel that if I was living in Long Island while reporting this book, I would have been afraid of being pulled over, you know, on a false pretense and arrested or worse. And I think that would have been a legitimate fear out here in Los Angeles. I didn't really have that fear.
I've been through that business a long time doing true crime and know a lot of cops. And I just know that sometimes you can kind of really put yourself in a bad place amongst them.
Yeah. And what the book is kind of about the you know, their insidious reach, which included, I think, reaching into every institution in Long Island, you know, the politics, controlling politicians, even to some extent, reaching, having influence over the sort of monopolizing newspaper of the area, which is Newsday, which is where I previously worked. And so I think, you know, reporters who went up against these same characters, while working at Newsday, sort of had a really hard go about it, you know, and one of the main characters in the book, her name's Tanya Lopez. She was a Newsday reporter who sort of described like this paranoiac experience of trying to investigate these guys and breaking news on them, really pivotal stories. And they were not happy about it. And so finding, you know, nails in her tires and not knowing if that was paranoia or that was them. And then, you know, also hearing rumors that sort of made clear to her that stuff from her HR file at Newsday was getting out into the world. And I even came across a document in the DA's office out there, which showed that the DA, who at that time was actively conspiring with the police chief against her, including listening to her wiretap phone calls, was also getting updates from an editor at Newsday about what she was doing. So it's a tough beast to investigate from the inside. So I think it worked somewhat to my benefit that I was, you know, an outsider investigating it at that point.
Yeah, I'm from Long Island, so this one hits pretty hard to home. And I remember reading about it when it first broke, and when I was visiting my family. And this one just always kind of stuck out in my mind. And when I was rereading about it, once I saw the guy's picture, I knew instantly who we were talking about. You know, in this case, the case of Jimmy Burke, the former police chief of Suffolk County. I mean, is this a case of like absolute power corrupts absolutely, or is this really something else?
The way that I you know, I think the official line, if you were to what's the arm of somebody in Suffolk County PD to tell you what they thought about Jimmy Burke, you know, in the top ranks, they would say, well, that was, you know, he was the baddest of all the apples, and we've cleansed ourselves of him now. And the Jimmy Burke is sort of like presented as like the boogeyman of Suffolk County, and that he's, you know, the bad guy who's responsible for everything, that all the failures out there. But I think in reality, and I think what I try to take pains to show in the book is he actually was just somebody who learned the ropes that already existed out there. He was a murder witness back when he was 15, of this notorious murder in Smithtown, New York, of a 13-year-old boy named John Pius, who was found in the woods with 6 stones stuffed down his throat. And young Jimmy Burke, who was kind of like a wayward teenager at that point, emerged, and he had this story to tell. And the prosecutor took him under his wing, and basically for the next more than a decade, Burke was in various trials and retrials in this case, testifying against his former buddies. And his story kept shifting, like exactly how the prosecutor needed it, and in ways that contradicted himself. And in reward, the DA's office gave him a career in policing. It sort of directly rewarded him. There's documents that I came across that make that really clear, that essentially his, you know, spotty background as a teenager was forgiven in response for his testimony in the Pius case. And then from that point, he sort of mastered the political element of policing in Long Island, which was, you know, partly manipulation of politicians, partly BSing, you know, lots of sort of jargon that like political characters could seize on, and sort of remaking himself, you know, whenever needed. And so he learned like this whole political system to the point where he and the prosecutor in the Pius case, who became the DA and was sort of his protector for decades, they became the most powerful people in an extremely large county out there in Suffolk County, and were, you know, formidable, and they really couldn't be tested until an unforeseen incident occurred, which involved a duffel bag full of sex toys.
Oh, that was mine.
You changed history, Al.
No, different sex toy bag. Different.
Oh.
More than one person can have one.
Oh.
AQ.
Well, how did you come across this case? Like, what brought you into it? Just because it was in your neighborhood and something you always wanted to cover? Or where did it all come from for you?
So I was at Newsday. I was on the investigative team. And I covered Tom Spoda, who was the aforementioned prosecutor, a lot. And I didn't cover Jimmy Burke very much because, yeah, I was not on that beat. But I, you know, while I was there, this conspiracy unraveled, sort of very slowly over years and pretty publicly, in which, Jimmy Burke, was ultimately brought down by the feds for having beaten up a heroin addict who stole a duffel bag from his police truck that contained the aforementioned sex toys. And, there was a long sort of cover up. And so as I sort of watched that unravel, I thought that was pretty interesting because, I mean, this is the one of the largest police jurisdictions in the country and the highest paid. You know, the cops routinely make $200,000 or more, and they have extreme power over the political jurisdiction and over the people that live in Long Island and particularly Suffolk County. And so I thought that was pretty fascinating that, you know, that the chief was brought down over that. And then what really sort of like brought it home that there's probably a book here was learning about his involvement in the Pius case and the fact that the DA had at the time been a prosecutor and had sort of taken him under his wing as a 15-year-old and led him into policing. To me, it kind of had like The Departed vibe. And then the more that I, you know, looked into it, even just looking into that Pius case in 1979, and just, you know, getting my hands on transcripts and reading through how troubled that case was, and how it was sort of an example of how cops and prosecutors out there sort of cooked the books and concocted cases that very well may have resulted in wrongful convictions over and over again. I just felt that that Jimmy Burke was just such a great example of like this troubled jurisdiction, and kind of like what it represented as far as how cops and prosecutors can operate.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, you know, particularly when the top cop in any state in any region gets fired. And I kind of want to take it from, I want to reach back to the top where he made his break was being an informant, or maybe a witness. I guess you tell us a little bit in a moment, from that case where a 13-year-old was killed. So let's talk a little bit about the fallout when that type of stuff happens with, and the prosecutor who was behind him and helped him rise through the ranks in police, in law enforcement, was then later actually disbarred as well. So, I mean, what happened with that case? I mean, was it reopened? Is the real killer still out there? I mean, let's start there.
Sure. So, you know, to give a little background on it, the body of John Pius was found behind a schoolyard in Smithtown, New York in April 1979. And this was a point when essentially there was a major exodus from the city to the suburbs. So it was a big deal because, it countered the myth that the suburbs were free of horrific crimes that were occurring in the city. And the prosecutor who was on the case his name was Tom Spoda. He had cut his teeth about 5 years earlier on another case that also countered the myth. That myth has to be countered a lot, I guess, which was the Amityville slang, which was, you know, probably one of the most notorious crimes in American history, in which a young man murdered six members of his family. So Spoda had sort of risen up the ranks following some notoriety for being second chair in that prosecution. And, you know, I think he recognized in Jimmy Burke a kid from Smithtown who was smart and sort of eager to please and eager to find some, you know, way to better his own life. Burke was one of several teenage witnesses who testified that some of the four defendants, who were all friends of Burke, had pseudo confessed to being involved in the murder, and the case really just relied on their testimony. There was no physical evidence tying them to the murder. The only other piece of evidence was a confession, which was later ruled to be coerced, from a 15-year-old boy, one of the defendants, who was separated from his parents. His parents weren't told where he was when detectives took him. And he was interviewed in the back of a detective squad car, and he was also not given access to his lawyers. And so what he claimed was that the detectives basically told him what to say, and then they tape recorded him as he said it. So the case sort of, you know, there was four convictions. All four convictions were then overturned. But the, you know, this was a case that I think was like Suffolk County does not give up its even dubious homicide convictions easily. And so they fought to reinstate convictions with two of the defendants. They agreed to deals which the defendant said they could not turn down, which essentially promised to let them out of prison with no further prison time in return for pleading to lesser charges. One of the defendants was never retried, and another one was reconvicted and ended up eventually being paroled. But, you know, as I was going through the case, there's so many conflicts and there's so many inconsistencies throughout the case. You know, the boys who were convicted, they were all convicted on sort of different tellings of the strikingly different tellings of what happened in the case, as if Suffolk County was sort of accepting any story in which they would, in which, you know, the individual defendant would either be found guilty by a jury or agree to plead guilty, even though the circumstances didn't line up with each other. The sort of star witness who first testified in the early 80s, later testified when he was a cop in 1990, was Jimmy Burke. And his testimony, like at times he would take, he would say one defendant said a incriminating statement. And then in a different trial, he would say that a different defendant said the exact same incriminating statement in the exact same place. So it's very odd stuff like that, which, you know, kind of seemed tailored to exactly what the prosecutors needed. And, you know, there's some really telling inconsistencies. One of them was Burke and other similar witnesses all sort of talked about how when one of the boys confessed to them, that he included in his pseudo confession that he put the victim's bike up against a tree. And it was one of those like sort of telling details where if you get, you know, not even that deep into the case, you can see that in fact, the bike of the victim was found on the ground. And when the victim's father arrived at the scene, he put the bike up against the tree. But the detectives who interviewed those kids didn't know that. They had shown up and the bike was against the tree. So it's one of these things where detectives probably seized on that because it, you know, it's a detail that only the killer would supposedly know, but it works counter really because it's, if it's not something that happened, why are these kids saying like it did? And it sort of suggests that they were fed that tidbit in order to incorporate it into their testimony. So there's basically a flawed history of the case that goes on for decades until the early 2000s. And because none of them are in prison, I don't think that there's been a huge push to sort of reexamine the case because there's nobody that you're getting out of prison. Right. But you know, they've spent roughly 50 years in prison total for this murder. And there's no physical evidence that they were involved and the testimony evidence is inconsistent and contradicted. So, you know, to me, it's something that it's a case that cries out for reexamination. And, you know, to your point, which I think is often overlooked in possible wrongful convictions, if they didn't do it, whoever killed John Pius, you know, could still be out there and has never been punished for it. And I think that's a really important point.
Yeah, it's pretty sickening. I mean, really different aspects of Jimmy Burke and his career. I mean, it is quite sickening. I mean, and that's really how it began. That's kind of how he got his big break. I want to kind of skip ahead to the end and how he pretty much was caught in between a lot of crimes clearly committed and abuse of power as well. But he was brought down by Alan, calm down, by a bag of sex toys, as you mentioned. Tell us a little bit about that because, you know, when I was reading about him, apparently his career was almost done before it even really began because he was caught having a relationship with a prostitute as a police officer. So to me, when I see he was fairly brazen as a young man and continued that throughout his career, and then he has a bag of sex toys stolen. I mean, to me, comparatively to dating a prostitute as a police officer, it's probably kind of not that much of a difference, or you probably wouldn't be scared. I mean, so do you think that there's something a little bit more beyond the stolen bag of sex toys, which then eventually led to his downfall?
Yeah, so.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You know, essentially what happened there was a heroin addict who was based in Smithtown, and everything in this book kind of happens, which I sort of enjoyed, within a few miles of itself in Smithtown. You know, almost everything in this book happens within a few miles. And I just thought that was interesting. And so this heroin addict named Christopher Loeb kind of habitually broke into cars and would steal whatever was in the car, essentially. But he would just jiggle doors. He never actually broke in. You know, he would not like smash a window, for example. So you're sort of like the lowest on the cast of criminal actors. And this is the guy who kind of, you know, changed the history of Suffolk County. So he stole a duffel bag from Jimmy Burke's Yukon GMC one night. And by the next morning, unfortunately for Loeb, he had a unannounced probation visit. And so at that point it was discovered that he had stolen the chief's stuff, and the chief, Jimmy Burke, then goes to the precinct where Loeb's being held. And he has three of his top detectives who he referred to as his palace guards, because they kind of handled everything for him, had already slapped Chris Loeb around trying to get him to confess. Jimmy Burke, unsatisfied that he did not confess, mostly because Loeb was basically strung out and like falling asleep during the beating. Burke then goes in and he beats Loeb pretty viciously, from my understanding, himself, and in an attempt to get Loeb to confess. And also, I think, just in an attempt to sort of show his dominance. So you're right. You know, he had before that point, he had survived every scandal. You know, he had a long standing relationship with a sex worker in his precinct when, as a younger cop. And he was basically given a slap on the wrist by IAB, Internal Affairs Bureau, essentially because he was protected by Tom Spoda, the mentor and prosecutor. And then later, and that was kept secret by New York's, you know, laws, which at the time kept secret everything, that all internal affairs records. And then when that emerged publicly due to the digging of the Newsday reporter, Tony Lopez, you know, I think there was, I think in Europe, that was shortly after he had been confirmed as police chief. And I think in your average jurisdiction, that would have been the end of him, right? I mean, it's such a major scandal that I think that typically the county executive or the commissioner would have said, Jimmy Burke is stepping down and we're finding a new police chief. But in this case, he and Spoda had by then just a complete death grip over the politicians and the voting bloc and the police unions of Suffolk County that he was able to stay in power. He was able to remain police chief. And so, you know, you're right. Essentially, the beating of Chris Loeb was less than a year after he had become police chief. And, you know, I guess sort of in your question is, was he motivated to beat Chris Loeb? And was he angry because there was, you know, perhaps something more in the duffel bag, perhaps a scandal which was bigger than any he had faced before? You know, what Chris Loeb told the FBI was that there was child porn in his bag. And that's something that's, you know, an accusation that's sort of percolated for years. I frankly don't think there's any evidence that there's child porn in his bag. I think that that what there was adult porn, which you know, police officers sort of helpfully placed on, they when they went through the bag in Chris Loeb's house, you know, they put it on Chris Loeb's dresser, you know, sort of helpfully giving it to Chris Loeb so that it wouldn't be embarrassing for Chief Burke. So I don't, you know, that's one of the wilder things about this, because what you see is this all-consuming cover-up by, you know, lowly beat cops, precinct detectives, top detectives, top corruption prosecutor, DA, like all up the ranks, this all-consuming cover-up that I think begins with just covering up the fact that the chief had a duffel bag that had sex toys, porn, Viagra, and sexual lubricant in it, which, you know, is a scandal that he would have survived. And then later the cover-up becomes, you know, the covering up the fact that Burke beat up Loeb. But in my mind, that's one of the things I found interesting about it. It just showed how quickly sort of there's like this unspoken instinct by some police to just, you know, disregard protocols. For example, they allowed Burke to just come into the crime scene and take his duffel bag and then go to the precinct and meet with the defendant. And while he was meeting with him, he pummeled him, you know, to disregard protocols and lie to federal agents, lie under oath, initially just to cover up, you know, the small embarrassing detail that perhaps the chief had a kinky sex life. And to me, I found that pretty interesting that's kind of where this all spiraled from.
Yeah, I mean, to me, this seems fairly tame in comparison, particularly when you were dating a prostitute decades before. So, like you mentioned, that this case is so wild, and there's some wild accusations now being thrown toward Burke, and I kind of want to see the veracity of how wild they are.
Sure.
The thief, Loeb, he also not only said that there was probably some type of, you know, I guess maybe child porn or something of that nature. Supposedly, he also said that there was a snuff film inside that bag that supposedly has links to the Long Island serial killer. I mean, he's a thief and a heroin addict, so he himself is not that reliable. But also, if you also look at it cumulatively, some of the other evidence that has come out since there, you know, soon after he became chief, Burke supposedly blocked an FBI's investigation into the Gilgo Beach serial killings, according to a federal source.
Yeah.
Also, in that same year, he was the same year that he was convicted, an escort also claimed that Burke partied with her at an unknown Oak Beach home and engaged in some rough sex. And Oak Beach is right where, you know, right near where Shannon Gilbert's body was, which was kind of kicked off finding all the other bodies in the Long Island serial killer or serial killers. Do you, based on all of those three things put together, I mean, do you think Burke has some legitimate links to whoever could be, or maybe he is, the Long Island serial killer?
Yeah, well, I guess to start with, you know, addressing the duffel bag questions, because, well, for one, just, you know, I think it's worth noting that Loeb, sort of his description of the child porn that he saw, as did his co-defendant, Gabe Migueles, who also was breaking into cars with him, was an adolescent. There was an adolescent on the cover. And as the FBI agents noted sort of dryly in some records that I saw, you know, typically child pornographers do not sort of make pseudo commercial versions of their covers. And it's usually a little bit more discreet than that. And, you know, as far as Loeb saying that he did not, that he found a snuff film and watched it, you know, he didn't tell the FBI that, and he didn't put that in court testimony. That's something that emerged later. And so I think you have to take what he says to some extent with a grain of salt. But, you know, at the same time, he's also somebody who was not believed initially, and when he went to court, you know, the judge and the cops testified against him, that were witnesses testified against him, called his testimony false. A judge agreed with it, with the cops. You know, this is somebody who has not been believed before, and hey, the substance of what he said previously, you know, turned out to be true. Although, you know, I think that there's a certain point where I'm willing to take that, and where to me, I grow pretty skeptical. And then, you know, the idea that has really sort of gained momentum over past several years that Burke was involved in the Gilgo killings, you know, I think, as you said, there's a strong foundation to suspect that he was orchestrating some sort of a cover up. And you know, you mentioned that he took the FBI. He did not allow the FBI to profile the suspect, him and Tom Spoda. I actually think it was mainly Tom Spoda, but I think they worked in tandem. And you know, he was sort of known for these dalliances with sex workers. He did have a history in that area. You know, the sex worker who gave an affidavit about him accosting her and hiring her and then accosting her, you know, her account was, I don't think that there was corroboration that occurred. But, you know, that doesn't mean that it didn't. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of smoke there for sure. And I think that's why people have seized on. But I also think you know, what I haven't seen is really any sort of hard evidence that you know, would be required to even think of a guy as a suspect. And in fact, you know, I find it somewhat unlikely that Burke was somehow involved. And then the feds, who, you know, really turned his life inside out and talked to his girlfriends and his childhood friends and anybody who knew him and made a lot of them cooperators. And studied his duty charts and studied all of his records, and really made him their project. For years, I find it sort of surprising that they wouldn't sort of find evidence that he was involved in systemic killings of sex workers for years. But, you know, that said, it's not smart money to bet against a conspiracy in Suffolk County, clearly, like, you know, as this book shows, because I think from the beginning, some of the stuff in the book seems outlandish and people didn't believe it at first. And then it turned out to be true. But, and I, you know, there's obviously a strong strand of sort of self-protectionism out there as far as police, prosecutors, other sort of political elite of the county. And so, you know, perhaps it's possible that there was some sort of a cover-up of activities that were going on Oak Beach, whether it be direct involvement in the killings or something else embarrassing, that Burke and Spoda didn't want uncovered. But, you know, I think something that's perhaps not as exciting, but also pretty real, is that as far as why they would have blocked the feds, is I think that these guys really just saw law enforcement as a sort of pursuit of, you know, glory. And I don't think that they were very involved in, I don't think that they really put much stock in sort of solving crimes for just because that's their job. And so I think that, you know, they may have been averse to the feds sort of swooping in and using their like highfalutin character profiles to help solve this case and cell phone data and all these other things that sophisticated departments and federal agencies use routinely. And I think that, you know, their worst nightmare for a guy like Jimmy Burke, his worst nightmare would have been the feds kind of coming into his turf and solving, you know, the highest profile case on his turf. So I think he might have blocked them because he'd rather it not be solved at all than have the feds solve it.
Well, regardless, what we do know is that he did get almost 4 years for the crimes that he did commit. But that was back in 2016, 2017. So he's actually probably out on the street right now. One, do you think like almost 4 years is too little or too much? And two, since he's probably out on the streets right now, I mean, what is he doing, if you know?
Sure. It's interesting, the 4 years, he actually paid much less of a penance for his crime than Tom Spoda and Spoda's top aide, Christopher McPartland, who were convicted of helping him cover up the beating of Loeb did. Because both of them spent years fighting it, and then they actually received longer sentences than Burke. The book is sort of written with the theme of these particular cops and prosecutors as an organized crime cabal. And I think by the end of the book, that's when Jimmy Burke is facing time behind bars, that really becomes clear. He literally says stuff like, through his lawyer, tells his lawyer to pass on to Tom Spoda and Chris McPartland that he's a stand-up guy. He's going to do his time and not talk to anybody. Essentially, that he's not going to snitch, which is sort of amazing coming from law enforcement people that, you know, traditionally supposed to encourage snitching, but they're so far gone from that, right? I think that sort of the way that he handled his case, which was kind of like a savvy mobster, and he literally had John Gotti's attorney, John Gotti Jr.'s attorney is his, was smart, you know, for him, because essentially what he did was he did his time, and he got out. From what I could gather, he's still around Smithtown, and helping him along was the fact that pensions in New York State for police are essentially never revoked, even if you're convicted of a federal top level conspiracy that took up, you know, years of time that you were allegedly working. So, you know, he still receives $145,000 or so from Suffolk taxpayers every year. And, you know, I think as far as a convicted felon goes, he's got probably a pretty cushy life.
Wow. So at the end of the day here, when you wrote this book, and when someone takes it home and reads it, what is it you're hoping that they take away from it?
You know, what I saw Burke as an author, what I saw his utility as was in exploring how police, who particularly unqualified ones, can really navigate like the levers of power, and how, you know, all the laws kind of work in their favor. The laws keep their misconduct secret. It keeps cases that are overturned because of their false testimony secret. And the way that politicians are sort of beholden to them. Sort of key to that is the power of the police unions, which are, you know, really, I think, come to life in Jimmy Burke's story. They're his fishing buddies, the police union executives. And even though he was a chief, you know, and so really he was the man that the police unions were supposed to be sort of battling, they defended him over defending their rank and file, which were detectives and others who he sought to destroy. And so I just found it really interesting, kind of, that, you know, there's been so many questions, I think, particularly in the wake of George Floyd's death, as to how do police amass this, you know, huge amount of unchecked power that gives them the impunity to, for example, put their knee on a guy's neck while other people are filming, and they think that they're not going to even lose their job, you know, or much less be convicted for murder. And I think the Jimmy Burke story kind of is a like kind of dynamic real life example of how that power is amassed. And, you know, same thing when Jimmy Burke beat up Chris Loeb, you know, as we discussed, there wasn't much at stake. He could have just easily just knocked on into the precinct and let his car theft be handled, you know, properly. But I think he just never thought, and I think he had a good reason to never think, that he would ever be held to account for that, or for the ensuing cover up, or for any of the misconduct in his career, because of all the insulating layers that he had built up over his career.
Well, so did you come across any surprises, anything that you were totally unaware of?
Lots of surprises. The whole thing was sort of like an exercise in wow, because the whole process really kind of, you know, drove home the spectacular power that these guys have, and sort of how brazen it is. I mean, I think I was somewhat surprised by the police union involvement and how sort of immediately they came to the defense of Burke in a way that was that did not strike me as legal, even though they have not been federally indicted, which was, for example, you know, there was a copious amount of witnesses of Burke first going to Loeb's house and then going to the precinct and beating him. And any of those police witnesses really could have started the process of burying Burke. And so he was in this fraught position where he had a lot of witnesses who could have done him in. But so what the police union bosses would do is they would essentially hold like live auditions where they would have the police come into their offices and they would say, and, you know, in a group, and they would say, what did you see that day? And people, you know, would, in like the form of like a creative writing workshop or something, each of the cops would say what they saw. And then the police union officials would sort of quietly, they would quite clearly, but subtly say what they wanted the story to be. So for example, they might say, you know, I heard the same thing, but I heard that Jimmy Burke didn't go into the interrogation room that day. I heard he just opened the door and poked his head in. And then the cop sort of understands, if I say that Jimmy Burke went into the interrogation room that day, I'm going to be jettisoned to some far off precinct counting case numbers for the rest of my career. I'm never going to make detective. And so you see with all of the various cops, detectives, you know, that they were sort of shaping their story that way. And it worked, you know. Initially the FBI were sort of defeated by how the cops wouldn't break ranks. And I found that surprising, just how brazen, you know, really sanctioned perjury is in a major police department. And one other thing that I also found pretty surprising was that, you know, you often hear this thing about how police are a bad the bad actors of a department are a bad apple, right? And it's not the bushel. It's just that you know, those are the guys that get the publicity, but most cops are sort of good. And you often hear that after there's like a police scandal involving somebody like the cop in the George Floyd case. And what I sort of learned in doing this case was, I mean, in doing this story, was I was able to speak to a lot of the co-conspirators in this case, including a couple of the detectives who helped beat Chris Loeb and then helped cover it up. And it was interesting talking to them and sort of realizing that at the beginning, they were kind of idealistic young cops, you know, and one of them had a really sort of kind of haunting childhood where his dad, who was a 2-bit wise guy, had beaten his mother almost to death. And when the cops came to his house, the NYPD cops, you know, he sort of described hearing their radios crackle and watching them sort of comfort his siblings and himself, and realizing I want to be an NYPD cop just like them. But then as he joined the force, sort of, you know, that's kind of slowly pummeled out of a cop. And I think it's because the examples above them are often very poor, and the departments sort of don't utilize their skills, but instead, in the case of this cop and others who were involved in the conspiracy, kind of turned them into like henchmen, right? And these guys became like the goons for Jimmy Burke. And I found that pretty surprising because I what I saw was there was those police officers who were sort of perverted, you know, against by the system in which they enlisted. And then there was others who did make an effort to kind of correct the system and like did try to tell people like the county executive of Suffolk County, hey, this Jimmy Burke guy is trouble. And instead they were just sort of ground under the wheels. Right. And so it kind of showed, this is what happens when you don't go along with that system is, for example, you might get your phone wiretapped and you're convicted of a crime for leaking documents to the media. So I thought, you know, I did not sort of expect to go into this with getting like a portrait that would sort of humanize some of the police involved, partly because I didn't know or I wasn't confident that I would get, you know, those guys to talk to me. But a lot of them did. They wanted to tell the story. And so I found it really sort of surprising and enlightening to see how that happens in reality, how, you know, that these are not the police, bad cops are not monsters. They're not created like overnight, but it's a inoculating process. And I found that really interesting.
Yeah, it would be. So how do people get a hold of you? Now these cops want to come find you. So do
you want to go to your
address? Yeah, address, phone number, website, whatever.
So I'm on Twitter at G Garcia Roberts, and so you can my DMs are open, so you can reach me there. And I'm doing 3 or 4 readings in Long Island, and I have them listed on my Twitter. I'm doing them starting on the 11th, I believe, at a Barnes & Noble, June 11th. And so I'm doing a couple of Barnes & Nobles and another bookstore in Sag Harbor. all out in Long Island, and I'm hoping that the audience is full of cops. I really am, because I know that cops have sort of, some cops out there have devoured this book. And some like it, you know, I think for some of the reasons I just said with my last answer, and some don't like it. And hopefully it'll be the liveliest reading at the Lake Grove Barnes & Noble in history.
Yeah. Well, it's always good to have a cop in a uniform, you know.
Yeah.
Well, it's been interesting. So everyone, you got to pick up the new book by Gus Garcia Roberts, Jimmy the King. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. This was fun.
Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino movie reviews.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.